Okay, here we are. My final performance. Won't be any encore, so enjoy this. You're going to have to rely on the recordings if you want any more.
Are you going
to
do a backflip?
No, I'm not.
A frontflip?
No. I'm going to return to slide 10, though we've already talked about this. And you all said that you understand it, but I'm not convinced. So let's talk about this just a little bit more. What's being illustrated here in this cartoon? What's the idea here? What do these numbers represent?
Is it linked?
Well, the actual numbers here represent, you can cheat and say it's recombination frequencies, but what's that?
Like,
what is a recombination frequency?
Is it like what we do with a cat where like part of it is orange and the other part is black?
No, well, you tell me, what is that? That's a totally different topic. But what is that? What causes that different patches of color fur in a female cat? No, now we went off into a different topic. What causes those different patches of color in a cat? No, has nothing to do with linked genes. Call that X chromosome inactivation. And why does it happen only in females for mammals? Because females have two X chromosomes, and therefore two of those X-linked genes. A male has only one X chromosome, therefore only has one allele, and X chromosome inactivation brings them to the same level genetically. Right, it evens up the score in terms of amount of DNA. All right, so that was that tangent topic. Now we can get back to what I started with, which is recombination frequency. What is a recombination frequency? Well, I would bet that it has something to do with recombination, so let's start there then. What is recombination? Arrange what though? No, not really. Recombination is a noun for a process, right? But a corresponding noun is a recombinant individual. What is a recombinant individual? Right, recombinants are not like parentals, but unless you know what a parental type is, that doesn't help. What is a parental type?
A parental type is a true breeding?
No, not necessarily. It is if you're talking about a dihybrid cross, which we were.
The parental type being, are you talking about it being like haploid or diploid?
No. Yeah, if we're talking about two different characteristics, right? Two genes and two characteristics, therefore. At the same time, that's why it's a dihybrid cross. And whatever those two characteristics are, there are traits associated with each of those, right? If it's a hybrid cross, that means one parent has different traits for those characteristics compared to the other parent. But a recombinant individual is an offspring that has a trait for one of the characteristics that's like one parent and a trait for the other characteristic that's like the other parent. right? Whereas a parental type has both traits, one trait for one characteristic and the other trait for the other characteristic, that are both like one parent and not like the other parent at all. Okay, so recombinant has a trait from one parent, from one characteristic, has a trait for the other characteristic that's just like the other parent, and therefore they're recombining traits of both parents. That's why they're called recombinants. Now, why would you, when would you expect this not to occur? Recombination. Or if you prefer, when would you expect it to occur, to be possible? What would you say about the actual genes involved that control the two characteristics?
It could only be possible if they're different from the parents. The two parents have different genes.
Well, the parents and the offspring have the same genes, not necessarily alleles. We're talking about the same genes. So, I'm not talking about traits, which correspond to alleles. I'm talking about the gene itself. So we have a gene for one characteristic, a gene for the other characteristic. If there's going to be recombination of the traits for those genes, what do you expect to be true for those two genes? No. Well, yes, in a sense, but I mean, even before we get to that point, recombination requires there to be a segregation of the alleles for those two genes, right? In other words, they need to be passengers on different ships, using the analogy we've been using. Right? So when would you expect... Yes, but what I mean is under what conditions, what can you say is true of those genes if you would expect it to be an easy 50-50 chance for there to be recombination? When is it easiest for them to go separate directions? Just as easy as it is for them to go the same direction, those two genes. In the ship analogy, when is it easiest for two passengers to go different directions?
When they're on two different ships.
Exactly. So what is analogous to that in genetics? What has to be true of those two genes if it's going to be just as easy for them to separate as it is for them to go in the same direction? Right. In other words, and what's another name for them being on two different chromosomes? Well, how would you describe two genes if they are not on the same chromosome? Which is the opposite of what you would call them if they were on the same chromosome. Well, what word do we use in that case? If they are on the same chromosome, two genes, what word do we describe? What word do we use to describe them? Linked. Therefore, if they're not on the same gene, they are unlinked or not linked. Okay? Okay, now you expect there to be just as an equal chance of recombination or non-recombination, which means staying together and being just like one parent, if two genes are unlinked, right? If they're on separate chromosomes, different ships, then those two ships can just randomly go the same direction or away from each other, right? That's what we talked about in the previous slide as a 1-to-1-to-1-to-1 ratio in the prediction based on the Punnett square, right? I should actually go back to. Remember when we talked about this in slide 8? 1-to-1-to-1-to-1 ratio. There's an equal chance of all four possibilities possible combinations of traits. One parental has both traits of the mother. One parental has both traits of the father. One recombinant has mother's body color and father's wing shape. The other one has mother's wing shape and father's body color. Those are the only four possibilities if you have two characteristics, each of which has two traits, right? There's only four combinations. Well, if they're not linked genes, if they're going separate ways or the same way, just randomly, because they're on separate chromosomes, then you'd expect all four of these to have equal probability. That's what 1:1:1:1 means. 1:1:0:0 is what you would expect if they're linked, right? Because if they're riding on the same ship, then the mother's allele for body color should go the same place into the same gamete as the mother's allele for wing shape. And the father's, and the same is true for the father. Okay? So if you inherit something, a trait from the mother, a trait for wing shape, you should also inherit her body color trait. That's what linkedness tells us as an expectation, right? But remember, it didn't work out that way. There were far more parental types, but not 100%, as linkedness would suggest. So it's not 1:1:0:0. It's high to high to low to low. There are some recombinants. So what is it that explained that? Why can there be some recombinants even if there are linked genes? No, independent assortment is why you would expect all four of these if they are unlinked. Because independent assortment only affects different chromosomes, right? That's the point. If they are linked, then it doesn't matter which way it lines up, that tetrad, those two are going to go the same direction. So if they're on the same chromosome, what is the only way that two genes can separate? Crossing over, exactly. That's what explains why even in a linked genes case, those alleles for those genes can separate and you can actually have some recombinant types. Now, why is it that you would have a low percentage like you have here? I mean, what would explain a lower and lower percentage of recombinants? Meaning, yes, there are some recombinants, but they're getting less and less likely. What must be happening to those genes? I shouldn't say what's happening to them. They're different cases. But if you keep studying pairs of genes that are linked, but you find that for a particular pair, the recombination, the recombinant types, there's very, very few of. What must be true of those two genes in particular compared to the others? In other words, what would make it less likely for the two alleles of the genes that are linked to be separated? Well, let's back up 5 minutes then. What did we just say is what causes the possibility for them to separate if they're linked? Crossing over. So since that is what causes them to separate, what would be true of the two linked genes to make that crossing over event that separates them less likely? And what about those locations or loci?
Together.
Which of those two? Those are opposites.
Right.
Which makes it less likely if they're closer together. Yes. Because remember, they're only it's not just crossing over that's going to cause it. It has to be crossing over where the chiasma, the crossover point, is between their two loci. Right? If the crossing over occurs on one side and you have the pair on the other side, they're still going to go the same direction. They're only going to be separated if you have a chiasma form between the two loci. So, to make that less likely, because a chiasma can form anywhere along the length of the chromosome, you must make the two genes closer together. Right? This is one big chromosome. These two genes, pretty likely. If you just randomly put a dot somewhere on this chromosome, yes, it might be outside of it, but it's a pretty good chance it will be between them because there's so much distance. On the other hand, if you have these two genes, almost all of the crossover events will be outside of that pair. And so when crossover occurs, they're still going to go the same direction. You have to have the crossover point between them so that now this one is going to go with that part of the chromosome, and this one's going to go with the part that was swapped with the other chromosome. You see what I'm saying there? And so this is what I was saying this grad student figured out mathematically. That's where the next slide, slide 9, comes into play in terms of the definition of recombination frequencies. So the recombination frequency, which is the thing we were looking at the next slide that we'll get back to, one we started with today though, is really just a fraction. It's the numerator, the number on the top of the fraction is the number, however many there are, of recombinant individuals when you go through with the cross, divided by the denominator, in other words, is the total number of individuals. And then you just multiply by 100 to make it a percentage, right? And the smaller that number is, he realized, the closer the two linked genes must be to each other on that chromosome. Because that's what explains for the unlikelihood of a chiasma to form between them. There's just not very much space between them. All right, so he took advantage of that before the days of us just being able to go in and routinely look at people's DNA to map the location of genes that are linked. So once you first know that they're linked, and you know that by paying attention to two characteristics where you see that there is a difference in their recombination frequency, because if they're unlinked on separate chromosomes, they're going to occur, there's going to be just as many parentals as there are recombinants, because it's equal chances. So that's how you determine two genes are on different chromosomes, if you always have basically the same number of recombinants as parentals. If you're studying two characteristics controlled by two genes, though, in which the number of recombinants is significantly lower than 50%, and most of them are parentals, then you know you're working with linked genes. Then he said, okay, now we can use this recombination frequency to actually determine where they are with respect to each other, these genes, on that same chromosome. That's what gene mapping is. And this was done just totally mathematically, never looking at the actual chemical DNA. And so that's what we have here for three different eye color genes. There are three different genes in fruit flies, the B gene, the CN gene, and the VG gene. It was about a 9% recombination frequency when all you paid attention to was the B gene and the CN gene. Also, about a 9.5% when all you cared about was the CN gene and the VG gene. But when you only paid attention to B and VG genes, then there was a 17% recombination frequency. So, obviously that means these two must be farther apart than these two or these two. And that's how you are able to put them into a certain order. And you keep doing that for all the genes that you know are on that chromosome, and you can get a map. Like I said, we don't have to do this anymore, but that's historically how it happened. Okay. Well, slide 11 just gives you a little bit more genes to bring this idea home. Now we have some numbers on here. The numbers don't represent base pairs or anything like that. Zero simply means this is the gene on the end, wherever it is. So zero is a reference point. And then these are recombination frequencies, bigger and bigger. I'm sorry, they're not actually recombination frequencies, because recombination frequencies don't get above 50. But they are relative distances from this starting point. But this was mapped based on recombinations of traits for separate pairs of characteristics, two at a time. Right? So you paid attention to just eye and body color for one experiment, and then eye color. These ones are RST, the little hairs. And so on. So you just keep doing that over and over, and you get a map. Okay. Let us go to 12. I'm not going to go back through meiosis. We've already learned that, or hopefully we've learned that. But I want to say something about what occurs in meiosis. Normally, meiosis happens without a problem, same as mitosis. Mitosis we're not looking at here, though, because mitosis is really only happening in your own body, right? And so when mistakes happen in those somatic cells, which happens, you know, throughout your lifetime, you're accumulating mutations. You no longer have the DNA you were born with. You do for most of your cells, but a lot of your cells have gotten mutations over the years from living. But you're not going to pass any of those mutations on to any offspring that you might have, right? Because your somatic cells, really, even though they're important to you because they make up you, they're really just a collection of cells that has evolved to protect and produce the cells that matter in terms of survival, which are the cells that you pass on, which are the gametes that come from your germline cells. So anyway, those are produced by meiosis, and that's why we care about those in terms of inheritance, right? Somatic cells are not inherited. Well, meiosis, of course, involves two division events, right? That's why there's meiosis I and meiosis II. And usually, like I was saying before, both of those divisions go off without a hitch. Things line up properly, things separate properly almost all the time. Impressively high rate of success. But not always. Mistakes can occur. Now, in the normal case, whatever it is that lines up, which is different in meiosis I versus meiosis II, remember, but whatever it is that lines up, something separates. And another name for separation is disjunction. To disjoin is the verb, but disjunction is the noun. All right? Disjunction is what happens in almost all cases. That's the normal thing. So if anything happens randomly or by mistake that prevents those two things from separating or disjoining, we call that non-disjunction. And non-disjunction is the mistake that matters here, because it leads to a number of total chromosomes that's different from the normal total number of chromosomes that the cell should have. Now, what is the word that we use for... Well, I shouldn't ask it that way, because that's confusing. But we've been talking about ploidy quite a bit, right? Which is, importantly, separate from N, but ploidy does have to do with the number of chromosomes as well, right? Just in a different way from N. Well, linguistically, when you think of the dichotomy of cell types, that's going way back to the beginning of the course now. What are the two cell types? Right, and what does in eukaryotic you have that EU prefix, right? What does that mean?
True
or good, right? So we use that same thing here. Euploidy means having the true or normal number of chromosomes. All right? And therefore, any number that's not normal, we just use the antonym of this. And one way that we make an antonym linguistically is to put an A in front of the word, like theist versus atheist, right? If it starts with a vowel already, instead of just A, we use A-N. So aneuploidy means not being euploid, which means somehow having an abnormal number of chromosomes for the cell type. Doesn't say how severe it is, just if the number is one off in either direction, too many or too few, or it could be more than that, then it's an aneuploid cell. Okay? Well, meiotic non-disjunction, meaning failure of things to separate properly during meiosis, leads to aneuploidy. And we can see that this is true whether the non-disjunction occurs in meiosis 1 or meiosis 2. If it occurs in meiosis 1, that's more severe in a sense, because remember what lines up during meiosis 1. What is it? The tetrads. No, not the sister chromatids. The tetrads, the homologous pairs, line up, right? And therefore the homologs separate from each other. Well, here, and that happened correctly for this homologous pair, but in this homologous pair, or tetrad, the two homologs didn't separate. Both of them went to one cell, and the other one got nothing. So, since that occurred in the first division, that means already the two cells that meiosis 1 produces are already aneuploid. And then when meiosis 2 happens, even if it happens, in a sense, normally, you started with abnormal cells to begin with, so all four of the gametes that are produced here are aneuploid, notice. These two are aneuploid because they have a chromosome too many, and these two have a chromosome too few. Both of those are problematic situations. Now, it should be obvious that having one chromosome too few is going to be a big deal, right? Because that means you are lacking all of those genes that are on that chromosome, which can be thousands of genes. And so you have effectively zero chance of living if that's the gamete that is used to fertilize the egg to become a zygote. It's not going to get past the zygote or early embryo stage. This, by the way, is just one reason why a lot of pregnancies self-abort. You know, a lot of times women are pregnant, they never know they're pregnant. There's no sign that they ever were pregnant. It just aborts early on in the process that they think they never became pregnant to begin with. There's all kinds of things that can cause that, but this is one reason. It's also, though, a problem to have too many chromosomes. Now, the reasons can be varied, and it depends on which chromosome you have an extra one of as to how much of a problem that is. But that causes various disorders, like Down syndrome, for instance, is having an extra chromosome, what is it, 13, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. By the way, when there's that specific kind of aneuploidy, specifically having an extra one, so you have three of them instead of two, because a diploid normally has two, right? Then we call that trisomy. Three chromosomes. Oh, trisomy with a Y, sorry. Okay, well, on the right half, disjunction went off properly in meiosis 1. So these two intermediate cells that are produced after meiosis 1 are normal. They're euploid. But then this one underwent non-disjunction in meiosis 2. So only these two gametes are aneuploid. These two that came from the normal one are still okay. And if either of these just happens to be chosen to fertilize the egg, assuming these are sperm, there won't be a problem. Only these ones would cause problems. Well, what do each of these oblong shapes represent?
mutations of the DNA.
That's what each of those oblong things represents? What?
Chromosome.
Chromosome, right. Each one of them is a chromosome. But I don't want you to think that the letters, A, B, C, whatever, are genes. They are actually much bigger regions of DNA than genes. Each letter here, A, for instance, contains hundreds of genes because it's a very long stretch of the chromosome. All right? We talked about mutations before. Mutation, by definition, is a change in the DNA sequence, right? But what kind of mutations did we talk about before? Those were all classified as what kind of mutations? The ones we've already talked about. Not these, the ones we talked about. They were all mutations that involved just a single position, a single nucleotide pair or base pair. Well, those are types. But if we're talking about a mutation that just happens at one position, one base pair, we call them a what kind of mutation? Point mutation, right. That's what we talked about before already. Here we're looking at much larger scale mutation. This is chromosomal mutation, not point mutation. And we saw that point mutation, depending on how it happens, can actually have pretty big effects, right? But a point mutation affects only a single gene, and therefore it affects only the protein that that gene codes for. And it could be neutral, right? Because changing just one amino acid, I mean changing just one nucleotide in that gene might actually still make exactly the right protein, a silent mutation, right, because of the redundancy of the genetic code. Or it might still be neutral in effect, even if you end up putting a different amino acid in. So it is a different protein, but if it still basically has the correct shape, it might do the job, whatever it is, just as well as the normal one. It could be bad, and it could even be better, right? That the fact that it can be better is what natural selection operates on. If it does a better job, then it's going to give that individual a chance of living longer and passing that better version on. So over generations, populations get better and better adapted. A chromosomal mutation, however, has a huge effect because you're messing with a lot of different genes. Even if you're moving a collection of genes from one place to another and the genes themselves aren't rearranged, the fact that they are in a different place on a chromosome or even on a different chromosome affects how they're turned on and off. Because remember, I said that most of our DNA is between our genes. That doesn't mean it's worthless. It's involved in actually controlling when the genes themselves are turned on or off, which is an important thing. Cells, in order to do well, have to express their genes or turn them on at the appropriate time and only for when they're supposed to be expressed. And chromosomal mutation can mess with that. But here we see different categories of chromosomal mutations. Deletion is the same word we use for a certain kind of point mutation, except this is at the chromosomal level. So the original chromosome, notice, had all the regions listed here as letters. Deletion takes out the D range and all the genes that it contains. So that's going to be pretty broad. That's going to be a bad effect, right? If those get deleted, they're still in the cell at the moment, but they're no longer part of a chromosome, so they're not going to make it to the cells that that cell turns into during meiosis to produce the gametes, and therefore the gametes are not going to have those genes, and that's going to be bad news for any zygote that would result. Duplication is just what you would think it is from the word. In this case, the BC range, something goes wrong and it gets copied and put in right next to itself. So A, B, C, B, C, and then the rest is as original. So that's actually a survivable thing, because you still have everything else intact and in the right relative positions. And in a matter of fact, duplication happens quite a bit, chromosomal duplication. This actually can benefit organisms, or species, I should say. Because if you happen to duplicate this BC region like it's shown, then that means whatever genes are in the B and C regions, you now have two versions of. And they might be important genes, which means you wouldn't want to mess with them. But now that you have two copies of them, you can let accidents happen in the extra copies that you have. Let natural selection just kind of experiment with mutation on them. And you still have the normal ones to work with, which will keep you alive. And so this is how new genes can arise that do things that, you know, that come into the scenes from kind of behind the scenes over generations. It's kind of a genetic laboratory when you have these extra gene copies to work with by natural selection. Inversion means to tip over or to reverse. So BCD becomes DCB, as you see here. In this case, nothing is lost and nothing is gained, unlike the previous ones above it. But like I was saying before, where genes are with respect to the intervening sequences of DNA nucleotides between genes matters as to when they're turned on or off. So this can drastically disrupt. It can cause a gene that should not be turned on except rarely, only when its protein is needed. It can turn that into what we call a constitutive gene. Constitutive is a word that refers to a gene that is stuck on. It's always on. Now, there are some normal constitutive genes, simply because the proteins they code for are always required in the cell, so it makes sense to keep them on. But most genes are not constitutive. They're regulated, turned on or off as needed. So when you turn a regulated gene into a constitutive gene by putting it into a different position on the chromosome, that can be bad news, because you don't want to make that protein only when it's needed, right? And then the bottom one is the least likely, I mean, it's the most complicated and therefore probably the least likely to occur. Reciprocal translocation actually involves two different chromosomes. And what happens is that some section from one chromosome breaks off, some section of the other chromosome breaks off, and they somehow make their way to the other chromosome and get connected. So this is a kind of like crossing over, only just totally abnormally. And it's not homologous parts that are swapped like it is in crossing over. These two chromosomes aren't even homologs to each other. This is number 3, say, and number 17. Those genes belong on a totally different chromosome from what they've end up in. So once again, even though there's no loss or gain of DNA nucleotides, you've disrupted the regulation of them. And also think about the fact that somewhere the break has to occur in an actual place, right? It's random where that is, and it's likely, since there's so much DNA between genes, that that's going to occur in a place that's not a gene. But it's possible for that split, wherever it occurs, to be right in the middle of a gene. And of course, that's going to destroy the gene, because now you have half of the gene on one chromosome, half on the other. Transcription can't work. So you've lost that gene, which is going to obviously have a bad effect. Oh, 14, this is just a specific case of reciprocal translocation that happens compared to others at a fairly high frequency. It's still rare for it to happen, but it's easier for this to happen chemically in humans. And I forget what results is the so-called Philadelphia chromosome, but I forget the actual defect that this causes in humans. It's survivable, but It's not a normal life. Anyway, it's just an example of reciprocal translocation. That brings up the final slide, slide 15. This is a kind of a different topic. Not entirely different. But all of the stuff we've been talking about in terms of how genetics works, except for when I said that environment plays its role in phenotype. Remember, there's an environmental component and a genetic component. But when we've stuck to genetics in all these various chapters, we've studied how things work genetically. There's a related word called epigenetic, which means above genetics, just like epidermis is above dermis on your skin, right? And so this affects heritability without actually changing the genes, which would be a genetic effect. If you don't change the genes, but it affects heredity, that's an epigenetic effect. And I'm only giving you one example of this. This is not the only epigenetic effect by any means. But what we see here is the idea of genetic imprinting. And imprinting is epigenetic because the genes stay intact. They're not changed. The sequence is the same. The alleles, I should say, really, because there's two alleles for each gene. But if you think back to the chapter in which we talked about functional groups, remember this? Remember your functional groups? One of those functional groups was the methyl group, which is what? What's the methyl group look like? See how much you've learned this court, this term? Yes, yes. It's a CH3, right? CH3 with that C also connected to the R group, to the rest of the molecule. And at the time, for each of the function groups, I was telling you a biological reason why each one was important, right? And you remember what I said about methyl biologically? Remember what I said methylation is? Well, what's the word hint that it is? What is methylation? Right, adding a methyl group to something, just like phosphorylation is adding a phosphate group to something, right? And so I told you a major reason why methylation is important back then. DNA is one thing that can be methylated. And by sticking methyls onto the DNA, it keeps it from being transcribed. So it basically, it's kind of like, you know, if we think about the genes being manuals in a library, how-to manuals, how to build the protein. Well, methylation is kind of like when you have a library that's gotten so big that they start making the shelves movable, right? Where you get these huge, well, you probably have never visited a library with real books nowadays, have you? But anyway, ASU has stacks that with huge bookcases that move together so you can't walk between them until you need them. Then you have to move them out. They actually move across the floor. So you can fit more on a floor than you actually would if you could walk between each of them. Methylation is kind of like that. By sticking those methyl groups onto a gene, it keeps the gene from being readable by the transcription factors and the RNA polymerase that would normally be involved in transcription, right? So it's like the gene is not even there. Okay, well, in imprinting, this methylation that occurs in one of the two alleles for the gene and not the other. And it's not random like it is for X chromosome inactivation. It depends on which parent that came from. And which parent matters actually depends on the specific gene. But in this case, this example using rats, it's the father's one, the paternal version. So this is not the father's chromosome anymore. This is just the chromosome that came from the father. That's the one that is not methylated. So it gets expressed. The mother's gets methylated. So if we have a wild-type, normal-sized mouse that is a heterozygous individual, because of imprinting, this mouse is going to express whatever the father gave it, because that's the one that is not going to be methylated, right? Now, for a homozygous individual that is the offspring of that one, notice for a homozygous, if you have two of these same alleles, you would expect those to be you would expect the trait to be whatever they're homozygous for, right? And it is, of course, even though one of them is shut off. But notice that you can have a another case in which a different version was on the father's one. This one is a recessive allele that, along with a normal allele, you would expect not to be expressed, right? But the normal one came from the mother. The mutant one came from the father, and therefore, since the mother's gets methylated, it's like it's not there. And therefore, even though this is a heterozygous individual, it has the recessive trait, which in this case makes it much smaller, the dwarf mouse. And that imprinting starts, that's during gamete formation. But it's going to be permanent throughout the lifetime of that next generation, if that sperm is the one that's successful in fertilizing it. Okay? And then when that next generation makes its own gametes, then it's reprogrammed. But it becomes continuous, just like X chromosome inactivation does eventually in the embryonic stage. This is even earlier, and it's for a different reason. It's not because of tightly coiling up with the histones like it is for X chromosome inactivation. This is because of methylation of a specific gene, not an entire chromosome. So most genes do not do this. We're learning that more and more are imprinted, but it's still most genes are the normal case, like we said before, that if it's an autosome you're talking about, then you have two alleles working independently, right? Here it can be an autosome and still have the effect of being sex-linked because one of the two parents' alleles gets turned off. But for an entirely different reason. Do you follow what I'm saying there in terms of autosomes versus sex chromosomes? For sex chromosomes, it works because a male will have only one half of those sex chromosomes. Here, you have both chromosomes. It's on an autosome, but one of them's turned off because it came from one of the two parents. That's what imprinting is. So that is the chapter, and that means you now know everything there is to know about cell biology. And you can use the rest of the time to prepare for the test coming up today.